back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. For those of you who listened to our Camelot 3000 reviews and enjoyed them, I hope, you're in for a treat because Gene is back. Hey, Gene.
Hello, everyone.
And we are starting on a new project, as we indicated at the end of Camelot 3000 that we were going to do something else, and we are going to do the 12-issue miniseries of Squadron Supreme. And this is one that I picked up as it was coming out. This was at the very tail end of my first run as a comic collector because I had stopped for a few years. I don't even remember if I really got through the entire series before I stopped, but I had read the entire series a long time ago, had not read it since, much like Camelot 3000. And I remember thinking extremely highly of this. And I, you know, we've read the first issue for the sake of doing it, and I'm gonna, you know, not gonna bury the lead. I still think extremely highly of this. I have said what could be considered heresy in the comic collector's world, because I've said I enjoy this more than I enjoy Watchmen by a fair amount. Watchmen is considered to be the breakdown of the superhero tropes and all. But that came out slightly after this. I don't know that there was any connection between the two, but this slightly predates that. I thought this was more fan-friendly, and I find that I find that occasionally Watchmen just is a little bit more pretentious in my mind. So for me, I always found this to be better. Having read the first issue, and we're going to go over it, obviously, in depth, but having read the first issue, I thought the artwork in Watchmen is a little superior. Not because of just the renditions, but kind of the layouts and the storytelling are really very, very key in Watchmen. So in this, I don't see quite that attention to detail, but that's my initial thoughts. I don't want to go too far into it. I'll say, you know, just as far as Alan Moore goes, that is part of the reason why I'm a little less high on Watchmen, is because I found Alan Moore to be pretentious. It's easier to write a story that is the breakdown of the world. In interviews, he's talked about how people steal his ideas. Meanwhile, he's taking established characters and breaking them down. So, you know, where is he? It's easy to write the last story. You know, people talk about the Action Comics issue, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. He's ending Superman's world. He has free reign to kill off every character, do whatever he wants with it. That's why I always felt, for The Man Who Has Everything, it's a superior story by far to me, because it's in continuity and it leaves things so that you can continue with the characters. It doesn't destroy them the way, you know, the other ones. I think anybody could write the final story, but to write one in the ongoing that's as meaningful as that, that's where you're impressing me. So for The Man Who Has Everything, to me, was a better story than Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. But that's my quick Alan Moore diatribe. What are your thoughts, Gene?
Well, this is probably going to be heresy for some people, but this is my first time reading this series. I know what happens, because how can you not, really, being in the comic books of that vintage anyway? But this is my first time going through and actually, you know, digesting it as it's intended. And so far, I do agree with you that I think it's going to be better than Watchmen. I think that there is part of the reason for that is these are not characters that are just being done in this series. They have a history. You know, you had the whole Squadron Sinister thing with the Avengers and all that. So these are characters that have been around, that when there is backstory that you're not just being told, it's backstory that people have experienced with these characters. And also, After all this, because it is Mark Gruenwald, they appeared in Quasar. So I naturally have a tendency to like these people. But so far, I mean, the way that this is set up in the first issue, because Watchmen is like, oh, things have been going downhill for a while, and this is kind of like the last act. The way this issue was set up, it's like most of these characters are going into this with the best of intentions, not realizing that they are about to become the ultimate villains. And well, it's hard to watch.
I think there's a correlation there with the Watchmen series because, you know, the ultimate bad guy in it is doing what he's doing because he thinks somehow he can do better.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes, you know, I've often said that some of the best stories, not all of them, it doesn't have to always be the case, but some of the best stories and some of the best villains are the ones who think they're the hero in their story.
Right.
So you know, in Watchmen, I think you have a case of that. And in here, you have this same case where they, you know, I don't want to speak heresy for our friend Professor Allen by saying anything negative about Dr. Doom, but part of the reason Dr. Doom wants to rule the world is because he believes he would be a better ruler than anybody, and he can do better than anybody. In his mind, he's being benevolent.
Of course, he
thinks he is. So, you know, I'm sorry to have interrupted your story. So,
I was pretty much done. But it's fascinating to watch the two ways that it goes about. In Watchmen, it's the one super smart guy who thinks that he can solve all the world's problems. In this, it's a group. And one of the top people is like, this is stupid. This is going to cause so many more problems. Why are we doing this? So it's going to be an interesting ride as we go through this for me.
Yeah, oh, no question. And I just think, you know, by way of background, the Squadron Sinister was originally introduced in Avengers number 70, so that's in 1969, and it just consisted of Hyperion, the Wizard, Doctor Spectrum, and Nighthawk, and they were certainly intended to be a play on the Justice League. Hyperion is Superman. Dr. Spectrum is Green Lantern, the Wizard is the Flash, and Nighthawk is Batman. And they fought the Avengers at the time, and then you had eventually, in a more convoluted way than I'm prepared to give a presentation on, there was an introduction of the Squadron Supreme as opposed to the Squadron Sinister, different Earths, different versions. But essentially the same characters, and the team expanded, and they appeared in the Avengers again, and then at some point they had appeared in the Defenders shortly before this, where Kyle Richmond, who is Nighthawk, in their world had been elected as president, and the Overmind took over, under hypnosis or whatever, you know, mind control. Him, and then little by little the Cabinet and other people, and they put the world into a very, very bad place. And that's where this story picks up. So, you know, there, as you said, these are established characters to some extent, and there is a background on them, and there's some characterization that's already been done. I think that they allowed them to come out of the shadow a little bit of their being just Justice League alternates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to backtrack a little bit on the Alan Moore thing, he did want to use the established Charlton characters for Watchmen, but was told no by DC, who had acquired the ownership of those characters. So all he did was come up with alternate versions of those characters just the same. So in many ways that parallels this, except he didn't have them being played with before he got to them as in the identities that he created. So that's really the only difference. I mean, it is still characters that were done as a, you know, a recreation of already existing characters. I guess before we start, you know, we're already waxing poetic on this one. I think maybe we should get your synopsis before we go any further.
All right. It is not quite Dr. Bill level, but it is still fairly long because there's a lot in this issue. All right. So Squadron Supreme number one, cover date September of 1985. Why are we doing these series that are almost exactly 40 years old?
That's a good question. I think the reason we're doing them is because we have very fond memories of them. Or at least in this case, I have a very fond memory of them.
Yes, and that era in general.
And yeah, that era in general is key for us. And, you know, this is a very, very well thought of. I think Camelot 3000 that we just finished before this has fallen a little bit out of the memory of people. Whereas I think this one is still, you know, comes up frequently with people. So,
yes.
But they're both just the same. They're both very highly thought of and highly thought of by either me or us. And that's why we're doing them.
Okay. All right. So the on sale date for this was May 28th, 1985. And thank you to Mike's Amazing World of Comics for that information. The story is by Mark Gruenwald. Pencils by Bob Hall. Inks by John Beatty. Letters by Janice Chiang. Colors by Christy Scheel. The year editor was Ralph Macchio, and the editor-in-chief was Jim Shooter. On the cover, we have the Squadron triumphantly coming at the reader while the image of Nighthawk looms in the background. The cover copy reads, "In their own series at last, the greatest super team of any world." Well, we'll see about that. The comic opens with Hyperion losing a fight to restore the Squadron's satellite headquarters to its orbit, and the title reads, "The Utopia Principle." Hyperion is barely successful in controlling the descent to the splashdown area, where he is met by Amphibian, Dr. Spectrum, and Whizzer. The quartet are able to move the dilapidated Hulk to the shoreline, where they commiserate on the run of bad luck that the team has been facing lately. Before they can get to Maudlin, the four heroes head off to meet up with the rest of the team. Meanwhile, Power Princess and Nuke are in Nigeria, meeting up with Hawk and Arcana. The heroes are flying over wrecked and abandoned vehicles on a highway, where they witness a large group of people taking things from the back of a tractor trailer. After a high and mighty speech about the state of things being bad enough and they shouldn't be adding more theft to it, an elderly man stands up to them, though, and tells them that these people aren't thieves. They're starving farmers who have lost everything to gangs and are only looking for food to feed their families. The heroes are drawn away by gunfire aimed at the people. It's four soldiers who have seen looters and attacked. No warning, they just shot. As the leader is speaking to Power Princess, two others loop around and fire on her. She deflects the bullets with her shield, but Nuke reacts, melting their rifles as well as their jeep. After the show of force, the heroes leave to meet with the whole team. Flying over the Midwest, Tom Thumb pilots a vehicle with Nighthawk, Golden Archer, and Lady Lark. They review the sad state of America with cities blacked out, mass transit in shambles, and no communication systems working. Tom Thumb and Lady Lark are confident that things will be fixed, but the Archer isn't so sure. They're interrupted by a fire, which is getting close to a natural gas storage facility. Tom Thumb and Nighthawk go to shut off the gas valves while Archer and Lark keep watch. Golden Archer shoots at a nearby water tower, dousing the area to slow the spread of the fire, but it's not stopped. Lady Lark uses her sonic scream to alert the two inside that it's time to leave. Nighthawk leaves while Tom Thumb shuts the last three valves. Getting out just before the explosion, Tom rejoins the rest as they head to meet their teammates. 2 hours later, the entire squadron is assembled in a temporary cave headquarters. We get a recap of what led the USA to be in such a sorry state. Nighthawk, as Kyle Richmond, was elected to the presidency, and then 2 years in, he and the rest of the squadron were mentally controlled by the Overmind. Hyperion escaped, but the Overmind also took over America's top military leaders and declared war on the rest of the world. After the U.S. defeated the rest of the planet, the Overmind took control of the other leaders. Richmond and the squadron turned Earth into a police state, where dissenters were sent to concentration camps. The squadron even started constructing nuclear missiles on the moon in order to attack other worlds. Before they could be used, the squadron was freed and defeated the Overmind. However, the world still sees them as fascist villains, while the rest of the world hates America for conquering then abandoning them. While everyone is in a deep despair over the state of things, Power Princess recaps her history. She comes from Utopia Isle, where a society of people genetically modified by the Kree lived in peace and harmony. After the atomic bomb was created, they all left the planet, leaving Power Princess as their sole emissary. She has been preaching about creating another utopia, but no one has listened to her. Maybe they will now. Hyperion backs her up, telling his origin where his adopted parents told him not to use his powers to interfere with mankind. He now believes they were wrong, since any use of his powers interferes with mankind, so why not use them to the fullest? Hyperion gives an impassioned speech about how they can stop war, crime, and hunger, how they can cure disease, heal the environment, and maybe even prevent death itself. Of all the squadron members, only Nighthawk and Lady Lark aren't swayed, saying the people might not accept what they want to do, and it might even make things worse. After Nighthawk pleads with them not to become voluntarily the fascists that they were controlled to be before, they take a vote. Only Nighthawk and Amphibian vote against. Amphibian, despite his reservations, agrees to go with the majority. Nighthawk, however, refuses. He walks out, resigning from the squadron. The remaining members decide to give themselves a makeover before announcing their plans to the world, including no longer wearing masks. They leave to inform their families of their plans to take over the world, again, and to do away with their dual identities. First, Hyperion goes to see Lonnie, his co-worker and potential girlfriend. He explains who he is, which she had already guessed, and that he can't now nor ever could he be with her. She tells him to leave in tears. Wizard goes home to see his wife and daughter, who he finds in a safe room in the basement, while Dr. Spectrum heads to his RV and strokes his ego. Hawk goes to see his parents only to find out that his father died when his heart medicine ran out. However, his father left Hawk a package with a letter and a new uniform. Power Princess flies to visit an elderly man who we find out is her lover of 40 years. Meanwhile, Amphibian goes and visits his dolphin family, happily forgetting the dealings of the surface world. Golden Archer and Lady Lark visit their apartments to find them ransacked and a dead body in Archer's, while Nuke goes to the hospital where his parents are undergoing chemotherapy. Arcana visits her family in an invisible home, seeing her oldest do some magic, and Tom Thumb heads to the squadron's satellite to make sure Adia, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, the AI he invented, is still operational. Nighthawk goes back to his mansion, entering through a secret tunnel only to find protesters outside the fence line. He calls and checks in with the White House, finding out that his vice president has resigned and Congress has adjourned after declaring the entire country a disaster area. Nighthawk then suits up and is visited by Hyperion. Hyperion tries to get Nighthawk to acknowledge their friendship, but Nighthawk wants none of it and ignores him. Once Hyperion leaves, Nighthawk is determined to become the next Lincoln, emancipating the world from the squadron's control. He heads to a secret vault where a chunk of Argonite is kept. As this is the one substance that Hyperion is not immune to, Nighthawk intends to make a bullet out of it and kill Hyperion in order to avoid the squadron's takeover. The next day, on the steps of the Capitol, President Richmond makes a speech while he carries a loaded gun in his pocket. He resigns, also telling the world that he has requested all of his cabinet to resign, fired the high-ranking Pentagon personnel, and will publicly disclose all of the congressmen who supported his policies. He then turns the podium over to Hyperion. While Hyperion is making his speech, announcing that the squadron will be taking over, Richmond pulls out the gun but cannot fire. This is because he believes by killing Hyperion now, the one person who was not part of the squadron takeover before, he will make him a martyr. Hyperion promises that in the next year, all of humanity's problems will be solved, or the squadron will relinquish power. The squadron members then remove their masks as Nighthawk thinks that he will find another way to stop them. The beginning.
I think this one may benefit if we do kind of a go through the issue from the beginning to the end together and discuss
yes.
what comes up, as opposed to just generally talking, because I think all the issues that we have will come up. What I'll say just in blanket though is where I said that the artwork doesn't hold up to Watchmen, and I've blasted, not blasted, but I've criticized Bob Hall's pencils in the past, and John Beattie, who's inking him here, I'm not overly familiar with him. I do think this is a well-drawn issue. I think the moodiness of it comes through. But I just feel like the place where Watchmen really does stand out to me is in the actual storytelling and the symbolism of the panels, you know, throughout the book. It's like every panel has meaning and every panel has something to it. So I don't think this issue quite has that level. And that's where I was criticizing it. It's not that this is bad at all. I think this is one of the best things Bob Hall has ever drawn. And again, I think certain pages have some shots in it that just really stand out to me. And I'll try and mention those as we go through it.
Yeah, I think the art in this, it skews more towards the Marvel House style than, because Watchmen was out on its own. It was like, hey, this is its own world. We need to create it all. And it looked like itself. This is more of, we need to still look like John Romita Sr. drew it.
Well, and I do think there's an element of, I don't want to say cowardice, but there's an element of, we don't want to separate this too far from the traditional books because we're afraid it'll, you know, make people not give it a shot.
Right.
I think to make it more user-friendly, you keep it closer to the house style, and that's, you know, that's going to work with it. I do think that this style varies slightly, though. It's almost like the house style combined with the Frank Miller, Klaus Janson darkness. I do see some of that in it. So I think, it varies off of it a little bit. It doesn't look like John Romita Sr. drew it at all.
Right.
But I do think there's an element to make it more just superhero-ish.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, it's much more classic comics than Watchmen is.
And I think throughout this issue, as we page through it, I think we should point out some of the parallels to the Justice League, you know, who the characters are based upon and where they stay with or separate from the traditional Justice League, because this is a breakdown of the superhero genre that's why it's so creative. So, I mean, we start right off with the Justice League satellite crashing down to Earth. So I think, you know, that the symbolism there is pretty strong, I think. You know, that this is not your, this is the Justice League when things go bad.
Yes. Yeah, but it also establishes, hey, where Superman could just push this back no problem, Hyperion is struggling just to slow it down. So we're already getting to the, okay, yeah, it's the Justice League, but nowhere near their power level.
And the shot of the satellite coming to Earth, you know, it probably would benefit from either some Kirby or George Perez type tech. You know, it's a little simplistic in the way it's drawn, but but still effective. I think they do a good job of showing the just the perspective of how large it is, that you have Hyperion down at the bottom and this giant ship crashing down to Earth. So
Yeah, and it,
go ahead.
I was just gonna say, you can see, just the struggle, his face gritting his teeth and everything. And it's almost like he could have been knocked out by it when he splashes down, because he's laying floating in the water as Amphibian swims up to him, as he has to rest because that was such an exertion.
And he doesn't even know if he was successful until he gets the thumbs up from Amphibian, who is Aquaman, who swims up to him because he steered this satellite to the water so that it wouldn't hit a populated area of the Earth. I wonder if they thought about doing something with Amphibian's dolphin family, and that he wouldn't have wanted them to come into the water. But whatever the case may be, obviously they were successful, and then, as soon as he gets his rest, Hyperion and Dr. Spectrum, who's the Green Lantern, need to, pull it to the shore. So there's another huge struggle there, and that's well portrayed too. Now, on the page, once it's on the shore, I do like at the bottom the shots of Dr. Spectrum, Hyperion, and Whizzer. I feel like it just shows the loneliness of the characters. They're just kind of, on their own, and they're in shadows, and just I think it's just showing the heroic life is not glamorous. That's the way I feel like that's framed to look.
Yeah, it's like they've had such a hard time of it that they're beat down. They're ready for this to be over, but they know they can't stop.
So then we cut to we got Nuke, who is, I think, Firestorm. I'm not even
I believe
100%
he's
sure.
supposed to be Firestorm, yeah.
And Princess, what is she? Princess what?
Power Princess.
Power Princess, who is Wonder Woman. And then there's, I keep forgetting the names here. We have Hawk,
Hawk,
Aquaman,
yeah, and
and then we have what's her name? What's
Arcana.
Aquaman? Arcana, who's Zatanna.
Yes.
So that they will come to where the people are looting the truck, and they're ready to just go with the government theory of, hey, these are looters, we have to stop them, until the older man gives a whole impassioned speech about how they're starving because of the way of the world right now. And then Hawkman just says, okay, people, we haven't seen a thing. Do what you have to do. Let's go. And that's when the firing shot starts on them. So we're already getting a commentary on whether or not you just go with the government plan, or if you impose your own standards to it. And I do think, that's something that you always have to consider is, not just blindly following the lead, but also looking into, well, how is that affecting everyone? So,
Right.
and I.
Well, it's like with these soldiers, because there's no warning. They just start shooting, and the guy in charge says they're looters. Looting's illegal. We're the law in these parts. Okay, well, that doesn't mean you have to shoot first and ask questions later. He is following the letter of his orders, not the spirit of his orders.
Yeah, and I think that, that's a commentary on almost, the World War II soldiers, the Nazi soldiers who, well, I was just following orders, and they're saying, well, that's not quite good enough. On the other hand, and with equal emphasis, you can't just go around doing whatever you want as well. So there has to be some form of order in the world, which I
Right.
think is factoring into what ultimately is going to be the decision of the squadron to try and say, well, we can impose a better order. So,
Yeah,
and
but
then you have.
as the soldiers had gone overboard, shooting at the looters, then shooting at Power Princess, Nuke goes a little overboard because he just blasts them and melts their rifles and explodes their Jeep while the guy's still in it. You see the the G.I. Joe, oh, he got out just in time before it exploded image, but it's still a bit, you know, of an overreaction. And Power Princess tells him, you know, hey, that's a little more than absolutely necessary.
And this is done in 1985, where there was still, you know, some Comics Code control over things. Mm. And I think had this been done later when the Comics Code kind of fell out of favor, he would have killed those soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
The story would have had him kill them. It almost looks like, if you look at that panel where he's blasting the Jeep, it almost looks like the soldier leaping out was added after the fact. Like, this could have been editorial, hey, you know, you can't do that. You have to show that they lived.
Yeah, yeah, he does look like a Color Forms figure, really.
And, you know, realistically, if you know, if you're trying to impose some realism on it, he's probably not, he's probably way too close to the Jeep to have come out.
You know, oh, he got shrapnel all up his back and everything. Yes.
Then we cut to, was it Tom Thumb, Nighthawk, Golden Archer, and Lady Lark. Lady, yes. Lark is Black Canary. The Golden Archer is Green Arrow. And boy, the two of them are just like right on point with that, with the whole relationship and the way mm-hmm. he talks to her and all. And then Tom Thumb is much more original because he's a take on the Atom, but he feels like more like an Earth 2 Atom than an Earth 1. He doesn't shrink and grow. He's just a smallish guy. He almost reminds me of Puck from the Alpha Squadron.
Yeah.
Alpha Flight, excuse me.
Yes, yeah. And he's this genius inventor, so he's like Gizmo from Teen Titans and the Fatal Five.
Yes, very much so. I didn't even think of that. And they're actually, you know, it's the first start of like a debate over, you know, what's going to happen, where's the Earth going to go from here. You know, Nighthawk, who was president of the United States, as Kyle Richmond, is saying he has no answers. So, you know, we're already starting with the, you know, the world we've set up, basically, that this world is a mess right now.
Yes.
I did think, and I'm at a loss to actually come up with a specific example of it. It would take me too long, and I should have made a note. I do think some of the dialogue, as we're developing this, is just a little too exposition-y. You know, they're commenting in ways where, like, it wouldn't be a natural conversation if this was happening, to clue the reader in on what's going on and how it's gone on.
Yeah, there's a little too much, as you know, stuff in here. It's like, well, if you know that I know it, why are you telling me? Kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm just looking. What is it? Golden Archer says, "I'll say it. We've seen most major eastern cities blacked out. The breakdown of all mass transit and communication systems. People scrounging for a meal. Looting sprees everywhere. You know, it's like you don't need to say all that if this was a normal conversation. Everybody knows."
But yeah, he would
there to let the reader know.
Yeah, he would. That entire first speech bubble would be gone and would just start with, "You're an expert in national affairs, Nighthawk," and go on from there.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, as they're coming, they're seeing fires and different things going on as they get ready to land. excuse me. I do like, this is an alternate Nighthawk costume that apparently was created for him by the Overmind when he was under mind control, or somehow, you know, put upon him in that.
Yes.
Thing. And I do think it looks very cool.
So, yeah. I mean,
I was disappointed to see it go away.
Because when he changes back in his mansion, he gets back into his original outfit, which shows his full face. If you're trying to hide your identity, this one, which shows nothing of your face, makes a lot more sense. Especially if you're the president.
Yep. Where do they go next? I'm trying to remember the whole storyline.
Yeah, so that's they jump in, they shut off the valves to the natural gas. And this, pardon me, but I happen to be in this field in construction. This makes absolutely no friggin' sense to me. So the whole
I'm sorry, glad we can get some some clarification on this because I wouldn't have known. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the whole idea here, and this is exactly what Tom's Thumb says, is a natural gas main surged and fed too much gas through the lines and caused a series of explosions. Okay. I can kind of see that maybe. And, but then he says, where are we? If the fire reaches the natural gas storage tanks, it'll send fiery gas through the entire system and the city will become an inferno. Okay. No, if the fire reaches the natural gas storage tanks, they will explode. That's it. Is it? They're not going to say, oh, well, now there's fire in here. Let me just shove it somewhere. No, they're still going to blow up.
It make more sense from an engineering point of view if they said if this were to get to the main tanks, it would cause an explosion that would be devastating to the whole city.
Correct. And instead of shutting off the valves, well, in addition to shutting off the valves to the mains, which makes sense because that's the ignition source, you would also want to try and vent the natural gas so that it's not all concentrated in one area, that it spreads out and it's lighter than air, it will just go up rather than out as the explosion will.
Okay, well.
But this is me overthinking it.
No, but it would have been fairly simple to actually put this in those terms. I think, you know, it's not that, or it doesn't appear that Grunewald had a great understanding of it and decided to simplify it by doing this, because I think it would be equally simple to present it in a way that would resolve it the way you say. You know, you could even just change some of the dialogue and even have it without even changing any of the pictures. That would have been easy enough to do. So I guess it shows that Grunewald didn't have your understanding of the engineering aspects of this.
Yeah. Well, in his defense, I've been working in this industry for 24 years, so I have a little bit more knowledge than a guy who just wrote and edited comic books.
And in his defense, he's working for a company where Stan Lee thought that magnets and transistors could do everything.
That is a valid point, yes.
So then they enter into a meeting. Is this... Are they? No, they're not actually in a salvaged portion of the satellite. They're in a separate headquarters.
Right. This is somewhere in the mountain, a mountain in northern Moreland, which I have no idea where that is, but it looks like it's probably Colorado. And
yeah, well, that's one of the things about this is, the cities and towns and all of that, it has that DC feel where they're all made up names.
Yeah, but this is a temporary headquarters that they set up, and it, for being temporary, it looks pretty well fit out.
Yeah, with all sorts of ductwork and computer systems and tables and different sorts of furniture. There's definitely something that would have taken a little time to create, but just the same, they all get together and they start their conversation, and they also recap what went on in the Defenders issues with the Overmind taking over. And they present it from the point of view of, everybody has a chance to say their part or their share. So I guess that's the way of doing the exposition and trying to make it sound like you'd have this conversation. That's probably my biggest criticism of this issue, is that the exposition is a little clunky at times.
Yeah, there's not a situation where, like, Tom Thumb says, well, I saw this happening that you guys weren't at. Or Hyperion, well, when I escaped, I saw these things going on. It's just different people saying, this is what happened in Defenders.
Yeah, this is what happened, even though everyone in the room already knows what happened.
Right.
At the page when the wizard gives his version of what he observed, the top panel in that looks really like Carmine Infantino's artwork to me.
Yes.
If you're very familiar with Carmine Infantino from Star Wars and Flash and other series that he had a big hand on.
Yeah, it's definitely the multiple flashes running across to show his speed and what he's doing, but it's well done. And this is all post Defenders. This is the aftermath of, yeah, the entire world is screwed up now. It's not just America, it's everyone, because America invaded, took over everything, and then just bounced. And now all the systems have collapsed, so people are fending for themselves, and it is not good for anyone out there.
So this is where we get the greatest meat of this story and the thought process and everything that's going on and setting up this 12-issue series is where they start debating what can they do to resolve this problem? What can they do to make it a better world or at least return it back to the status quo it had? And they ultimately conclude, after much debate and with some dissension by Nighthawk, that they can make it a better world altogether. They're not going to try and return it to the way it was. They're going to try and make it better. They're going to solve starvation and disease and crime and all of these things that are existing because they think they can do a better job of it. And I mean that really is the meat of this whole 12-issue miniseries is what do they say? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And certainly they have good intentions. These are not people who are wanting to take over because they are power hungry. They want to take over because they think they can do it better.
But again, as you stated before, they think they're doing the right thing for everyone. That doesn't mean it is the right thing. And anytime you have some type of autocratic system of government, whether it is for the best intentions, whether the people voted for it. Julius Caesar is a great example of this. He was the best person for the job, so the Roman made him dictator, and then dictator became emperor, and emperor became hereditary. And we go from Julius Caesar and not too far down the line to Caligula. So it doesn't matter what your intentions are when you set up that much centralized power with one person or a small group of people, it never ends well.
And it's, the ultimate saying that we've heard a million times of power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So,
Precisely.
and again, it's not necessarily for bad intentions. And I think we're going to see that as this series goes on, that they're going to do things for good intentions that are wrong. So,
And we'll also see, and I know at least part of this is we'll see people in this group using the stuff made for good intentions for purely selfish and, in my opinion, evil intentions on another member of this group.
And we're going to, yeah, we'll see that as it develops. But it's, I think it's, like I said, I think we're laying the groundwork here, and it's a solid foundation because there's this debate on this could go on and on and on, and they present the debate well. What's surprising is how Nighthawk is the only one in a group that should be heroic and have heroic purposes. And again, they all have good intentions in how they're doing it, but he's the only one who's stepping forward and saying, "Hey, this isn't the way to do it." Everybody else is. The only other one is, I think it's what's her name, Lady Lark. Is she the one who has
Yeah,
CPR and some second thoughts?
she just basically says that she's not sure and that they may be going about it the wrong way, but she also votes for it. So she has some reservations, but it's not enough to go against the group. And I don't know if that's because her character is just, oh, I should just go with whatever these people are saying, or if she really thinks, oh, well, if Hyperion and Archer and Power Princess and all these people are for it, then I must be wrong. I don't know if she's a follower, just not has the courage of her convictions.
And it's easy to relate that to real life. Obviously, none of us have been in this situation, but I think it's
Right.
easy to relate when you're in a group and something comes up that you're really not so keen on, but you say, you know what, I'll just go along with everybody, what everybody wants. Now, this is on a much higher level, but I think, I think we can all relate at least to some level on that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's just, I don't want to make waves.
Yeah. So now we go off from that meeting and everybody has their own little individual moment where we and I think this is important to the book because we're getting some characterization for each person here, or each one that's presented at least. So we start with Hyperion and his Lois Lane, and letting her know that, he can't, like you said, telling her his secret identity, which she already suspected from the beginning, but then telling her that he can't be with her the way that they would want to. And then, leaves her alone crying.
Yeah. Now, to her credit, though, he flew in through her window and she immediately shot him three times. Because, as she said, you can't be too careful.
And even if she was afraid, oh, it might be Hyperion, she would know that it's not going to do anything to him anyway.
Right.
So the what she did would be potentially deadly to a looter or thief, but not to him.
Yeah, and I like how because the power's out in the city, all everything here is in blues and yellows. And the yellow is because she has a flashlight. And or you get some light coming in from the window, but it's just it gives you that depressing mood, which is perfect because he's telling her, "Yeah, I'm never going to see you again. Bye."
So next one is the wizard. The what I always say is the poorly named wizard, just because of the connotation you could take from that.
And the color of his costume.
Yes, that too. But I mean, the wizard, I mean, that name goes back to the golden age with the Marvel hero, the wizard,
Yeah.
who at one time thought he was the father of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch. But he's got his family pretty much in a bomb shelter, so they're cared for, but they're totally isolated. And what's it, just his wife and daughter? I don't think there's two kids. I think there's just
No, it's
his
just his
wife.
wife and daughter. And what I find amusing about this one is this predates Wally West because he's the first Flash to get married and have children. And it's perfect because it's like, oh, I need to check on my family. And note how in this entire page, like where Hyperion basically came right out and said, hey, here's who I am. I'm not ever going to see you again. And we couldn't be together anyway. He doesn't say anything. He's just holding his family and he's not going to ruin this moment. So we don't know how he told them.
We also don't know how he feels about their plan.
Right.
He went along with it, but maybe he's got second thoughts because of his family. Or maybe he's wholeheartedly in it because of his family, thinking he's going to create a better world for them, and they won't have to stay in this bomb shelter any longer. But either way, he's got his family protected, so he did take care of that first. Then we cut to Dr. Spectrum, the Hal Jordan copy. And I think it's kind of cool the way he's presented. He's basically an egotistical ladies' man who, he's calling, like he doesn't even know who to call. He doesn't have one person who's special to him. He's got to look at his, think about what, who am I going to contact anyway? He opens up a beer with his powers and he's just hanging out shirtless, which to me would be kind of a show a little sign of ego that he's, he thinks he's God's gift.
Yes. And his thoughts say that too. It's I mean he's and I didn't realize this, but he's apparently an astronaut. Is there's
Right.
I'm guessing the picture behind him is when he walked on the moon. So it's like, there's that's a really small number of people. But and he says, hey, could try to call NASA? Nah, they know I got weird stuff going on anyway. They don't need to be warned. So, okay.
So then we have Captain Hook goes to his mom and dad's house, and we learn that Captain Hook is apparently a legacy hero, that his father was, I guess, the original Captain Hook.
Well, his father was American Eagle.
Oh, that's it. Okay. And his father passed away while he was gone, as you said in the synopsis, because he couldn't get his medication. But he did create a new uniform for him. Next, we have Princess Power, or the Power Princess, whatever, whoever she is.
Yeah.
And she's got her Steve Trevor from World War II, but now he's an elderly man in a wheelchair. And she still loves him, but, you know, he obviously knows that they don't have the same ability to have their relationships. So, you know, that's something where they've played upon that in the comics, you know, with Superman and Wonder Woman and Thor, and, you know, that they're going to outlive all the people who they're close to, and that this is, you know, this is just a chapter in their lives as opposed to their life.
Right.
Next is Amphibian, and I thought it was interesting that his, you know, that we didn't get a world of amphibian people. And we just got the dolphins that he speaks to, and they're showing themselves to be, you know, quite intelligent.
Yeah, and I'm not an Aquaman expert by any stretch of the imagination, so I don't know if this kind of thing with Aquaman predated Peter David, but
this would predate Peter David. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in Aquaman, you know, whether Aquaman is raised by dolphins. Okay. So this is just,
I don't believe Peter David came on until the '90s as far as
correct. Goes. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if he got his idea from this or what. But I mean, it makes sense, because if you don't have a city of Atlantis that he comes from, he's got to go with, you know, whatever sea life is there. I just want to know how these dolphins are breathing, because he seems to be pretty far down for a while, and they kind of need to go up for air at some point.
Yeah, that's true. And I could imagine that they didn't think about that when they did this, because they're not showing them to have any sort of air supply, and I don't mean the soft rock group.
Yeah.
Next we have the Golden Archer and Lady Lark, and we learn a little bit more about her, that you know, she was a singer, and that somehow the advent of her superpowers caused her that she can't sing anymore. She, you know, she has the, I guess, this, you know, the siren scream like Black Canary, but I guess if she tries to sing, that's what would come out.
Kind of like Black Bolt.
Yeah, well, but she can talk.
Right, she can talk, but if she tries anything beyond just talking, then, you know, she's going to destroy whatever's in front of her.
Which, you know, that's a fair trade-off as far as I'm concerned. Don't get me angry. Don't make me yell at you. And then we have a dead looter in Golden Archer's home, which I would think could be motivation one way or the other. That could be motivation of, yes, we have to fix this, but it could also be motivation of, well, you know, the problem is deeper than just us taking over.
Right. Yeah. And what I find interesting, though, is that he says that he can't show this to Lark because she's a bit squeamish. I'm like, oh, she's a superhero. I'm sure she's seen stuff like this before. Is he not thinking highly enough of her, or has he been protecting her from these kind of things?
I'm taking it as him protecting her when he can.
Right.
But I, you know, I also don't know if he's afraid that that's going to influence her one way or the other, because she had her doubts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he might be afraid, you know, she's on board, let me just not rock the boat.
Right.
So then we cut to Nuke, who's supposed to, you know, a Firestorm alternate. And both his parents are sitting in beds on chemo and clearly have advanced cancer. I don't know. Do they say? I don't recall them saying that. Was there any point where either his powers caused the cancer or what gave them cancer gave him his powers or anything like that?
It doesn't mention it in here, and I'm worried that it's his having the powers, it's what gave them cancer, because that's why he can't bring himself to say, "Hey, I'm Nuke, this radiation-powered hero."
That would make sense, and it also would make him a very tragic hero, which is, a very common trope.
Yes.
So then Arcana has her family, which is three kids and a husband, and they're off in their own little private world that she's accessed for them. So she, much like the wizard, she has her family protected from everything that's going on.
Yeah, it's very Dr. Fate. Yeah, it's the tower, the invisible tower in Salem or wherever this is supposed to be.
Right,
Oh,
yeah.
it's Dahmer-Shen, New Troy. So yeah, it's somewhere in New York.
I've never been to Dahmer-Shen,
No. I
but
hear
I
it's
hear
a great place for a German festival.
maybe Wayne Newton can sing about it. I find it the next guy we have is Tom Thumb, and I find him so far of the characters who I'm not really familiar with, he's the one who fascinates me the most. Because again, he's not a strict Adam prototype. He doesn't shrink and grow. Like you said, he's more like the guy from Teen Titans. And he's also got what is very current, considering this is 40 years ago, that his relationship is with AI.
Yeah.
So, with the advent of so much AI in the world, I understand that there are people who are now, people who are recluses, and that they are forming a bond with AI, and they feel like it's a real relationship, and that there's problems, psychological problems that are developing because the AI just gives them constant approval for everything they say and everything they do, and it's creating problems for some people. Me, I just use AI to create fun drawings and stuff. What do I know?
Yeah, it's tough because like I don't necessarily think it's AI based, but it's non-reality based. One of I want to say that she's Kira's friend, but the way Kira treats her is more like an acquaintance. But she doesn't live that far from here. She only goes to school online, and when she's not doing school stuff, she's on a VR game. It's like she's not interacting with anyone. She doesn't go out. She only deals with people online, and that is not good at all.
No, I think it's a bad thing. That's obviously a more extreme case than the average person. And there's certainly more extreme cases than that. But I've had many conversations with a lot of different people about how the pandemic and the lack of socialization that it created has hurt the development of social skills in so many of the younger people, and probably to some extent older people, but I think most of those older people have already had those social skills developed, so I don't think it's as prominent in them. But in younger people who are developing social skills, I think there is more of a tendency to shy away from it and to have interaction with people by text or by social media than there is by actual physical contact with people and physical interaction and conversations like we're having right now, as opposed to I get the message, I could sit and think about what I'm going to say, and then I message you back, which is a totally different level of communication. So that's a problem that certainly has an element of in today's society, and it's beyond what we're seeing in this book, and I imagine it's beyond anything that we're going to see over these 12 issues, because it didn't exist to this extent back then.
Right.
But it's almost like this is predicting it.
Yeah, it is. And it's frightening.
So next we cut to our most complex character as far as his motivations and actions, and that's Nighthawk. He also has the most sophisticated history of the characters, having been president and having had his mind taken over and things like that. And he's got, you know, he uses his Batcave entrance, which I assume is similar to the entrance in Batman 66, where the thing goes down, he drives over it. And he gets into his mansion.
New Troy, 14 miles.
he comes in behind a grandfather clock where he's got the secret entrance, and there's people outside, you know, picketing. Now, I don't understand exactly why he puts on his old Nighthawk costume, because he's not planning on using it or going out. I assume it's just for the comfort level.
I think so. This is what he's thinking at the one point is, maybe getting out of this fake uniform the Overmind made me wear and back into my real one will do me some good. So it's probably one of these things where it's like Bruce Wayne is the mask and Batman's the real person.
Yeah, so that makes sense. And then he says, wearing my old tugs does make me feel a bit better. They remind me of a simpler time when I was actually my own man, when I was actually able to do some good for society. So I guess it is purely for psychological comfort.
Yeah. But I find it amusing that he's doing this in a room that has a huge window in it. Because that's how Hyperion shows up. It's like, oh, you're doing this with this huge crowd of people outside in front of a window. You really don't give a damn about your secret identity, do you?
I honestly don't think he does at this point. So we have, you know, Hyperion's looking for some sort of message from Nighthawk that he approves of what they're doing, or that he's going to back them up in what they're doing. And he really doesn't give them that. He isn't even really willing to acknowledge the extent of their friendship, which clearly does exist, which, you know, Hyperion leaves unsatisfied.
Yeah, I mean, because Nighthawk, he's refusing to talk to him at all. It's just, you know, you've made this decision. I'm not going to be able to talk you out of it, so why are you here?
So he heads down to his night cave and creates a, you know, effectively a kryptonite bullet.
Mm-hmm.
So then you know, he arranges for the press conference. And Hyperion tells them of his plans to take over, and he's got his gun. And it's a little, I think it probably is pushing the logic a little bit that he could have this gun up against Hyperion and nobody knows.
Right. Especially he is right behind him making this face like he's going to kill him. And no one says, what's going on here? Why is the president so close behind Hyperion while he's speaking? And it just doesn't make sense.
He takes the gun out of his inner jacket pocket. And it's very clear he's doing it in the visuals for the comic. And you would think somebody would see this.
Yes.
But, you know, they don't. And ultimately, he can't pull the trigger. You know, his morality prevents him from killing his best friend. And he's, you know, he's cursing himself as a coward, effectively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Hyperion has his arms raised, and they all reveal their secret identities, or they reveal their real faces, at least. He says, with this act, I hope you will all join us in ushering in a new age of trust and friendship and unity for all the Earth. So we've totally laid the groundwork in one issue.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Yeah, but the thing about Nighthawk, though, is it's, I think, I don't, if it were me and there were more pages, I would have had him set up like, okay, he gave a speech, he goes back into the Capitol, goes up into the dome, gets a sniper rifle, and tries to shoot him. Yeah, that wouldn't logically make more sense. But it's also the fact that, you know, one, it's his best friend. Two, the squadron after the Overmind has not done anything yet. So I don't think his morality is letting him say, I'm going to kill this man who didn't do anything, who wasn't mind controlled. I just can't do it. He has not committed a crime yet. So he can't murder Hitler as a baby.
Yeah, it's the age old kill Hitler as a baby question. And that one's always fascinating when it's presented. And it goes to, you know, it's real easy to say, oh yeah, I would do that. But you're standing at a crib with a baby there, or you're mm-hmm. standing behind your best friend who, despite the fact that he has wrong thoughts, has the best of intentions.
Right.
There's no evil in what he's trying to do. Or at least what he's explained that he's trying to do. And the others are backing him on it. And again, we're going to get into how they use this and what they use it for. And, you know, do they get corrupted by it? But for now, their intentions are all, you know, for the benefit of humanity. So it's, you know, I don't know that I'd be able to pull that trigger either. It's easy to sit here right. and say you could do it.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of if he had been able to do it, he wouldn't have been an actual hero. He would have been, like he said, you know, thinking about earlier, he would have just been John Wilkes Booth. Everyone would have seen him as, oh, this is someone trying to do, you know, bring our country back, and you just shot him.
But if you are a true hero, then you're not doing it for the sake of what your public relations are going to be after the fact. You're not sitting there saying, oh, right. I can't do this because I'm going to be poorly thought of in history. You're doing it because you know it's the best thing for humanity. But it's easy to read ahead in the story or to know mm-hmm. you're reading a dramatic story and figure, well, there's got to be conflict coming up. And
right.
say, well, you know, this is something he could have avoided. But if you put yourself into the shoes of the character at this moment, he doesn't know for a fact that he's right and what's going to go on. He just knows that he doesn't think what they're doing is right. He's got his convictions, yeah. but he doesn't know what the future is going to bring. He doesn't yeah. know how they plan on implementing this control over the world.
That hasn't exactly.
been established yet. So it's not so easy to say, well, you kill him and, you know, things are going to be better. There's got to be at least some part of you that's saying, boy, if I kill him, maybe I'm preventing things from getting better.
Right. Because, I mean, this is like Hyperion, like Superman, is the pinnacle. He is the one that they're all striving to be like. So if he's involved, then hopefully it is going to go the correct way. The method, Nighthawk doesn't agree with the methods, but he likes the end result of solving the hunger problems and the medical problems and everything. He loves that result. He just doesn't agree with the means to get there. But if Hyperion is still there, maybe his morality will shift it in the correct way.
You never, you know, you don't know at this point.
Yeah.
So, you know, that leaves the great unknown to come. So, you know, it just, to me, it is, again, a foundation of cement. This is not a foundation where you're thinking, oh, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know if this is a good story. There's so many questions to be presented in these 12 issues. And
yes.
your only hope going into it is that they can do it in a way where you know, where you're satisfied with the way they present it.
So, exactly. You
know, and you know, history tells us we are satisfied, but I don't remember exactly. I remember the broad strokes, but I don't remember exactly how it develops over the course of this 12 issues. So, you know, it's going to be fun to look at them. And, you know, much like we did on Camelot 3000, you know, next time we do this, we'll do issues 2 and 3. You know, we're not going to do one issue each time. And I look forward to getting together and doing that. I think we just have to rate this one at this point. And I'm going to say, the cover, I feel like the cover could be better. I'm not really crazy. Mm. It's not the layout that bothers me. In fact, I think the layout is pretty solid. But I think the actual drawings could be better. And I think that the color scheme could pop a little better. So, again, I think for layout it's fine, but the actual execution I think could be a lot better. So I'm gonna say a B minus on the cover. It's not a bad cover. It just could
Right.
be it could be iconic, and it's not. The interior art, as I said, it's not up to the Watchmen level, but it is very good. This is as good as I ever remember seeing from Bob Hall, and I think it's moody. It creates a lot of just tension as it's going along. I think the storytelling could be slightly stronger, but it's really not bad. It's just not as symbolic. Again, I'm being a little poisoned by having seen other stuff. So I'm gonna say an A minus. I think it's very good. I just think it could even be better. And I'm gonna say the same on the story, an A minus. And the only reason it's a minus is because I do think some of the exposition is clunky. Otherwise, I think this would be an A plus, frankly. And overall, I'm gonna give the book a solid A.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you on all that. The cover is a good cover. It does the job, but it's not, this is not a poster I would hang on my wall. It gets you the idea of, oh, Squadron Supreme and Nighthawk separate from them. Okay, great. So I'll give it a B on that. Yeah, the interior art. There's a couple panels where it's like, this is a little off, but then there are the others, like, with Dr. Spectrum with his face all shadowed and gives you the moody stuff, and where there's action, he handles it really well. So yeah, I'll go with you on A minus there. And yeah, I know the reason for it, because this era, it wasn't, oh, well, if I look at this, this comic and it has the editor's note, I can go back and find that immediately. No, you can't. So the principle of this is your first time with the squadron, but they have this history. We have to tell a backstory. It's just, it could have been done in a more organic way, probably, than the all the as you know isms. So yeah, but it does set everything up solidly. We know where we're going from here, and it's probably just going to be a full out race to the finish on it. So yeah, A minus, but the book itself, all that together comes together as an A, and I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of this.
Yeah, me too. And I hope our listeners are enjoying it and looking forward to it as well. And please give us some feedback if you have any thoughts and if there's anything we missed. I'm sure there's something we missed. But thank you everybody for listening, and thanks, Gene, for taking on this project with me.
Oh, it's good to have another 12-issue series to go through with you.
I'm looking forward to it. And thank you everybody again, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy, all rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.